KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for listening in today. Today I'm very excited to have on someone that's doing very interesting work studying search engines, Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School. Frank is working on a very interesting project and a paper which he is entitled Fairness and Accountability in the Law of Search. And what Frank is taking a look at is an interesting area involving the Internet. As everyone that uses the Internet knows, the basic way that people interact with it is through search engines. If you want to look for pretty much anything, there's a search engine query that you can do, whether through Google or any number of other Yahoo or any number of other search engine portals, and you can find tons of information. There's a lot of questions that revolve around the operation of search engines, ranging from how the results are gathered to what search engines really do. And one of the interesting questions that Frank has taken a look at, and something that we're going to be discussing in detail today, is whether search engines themselves should be regulated. One of the topics that we've discussed several times on this show in the past is the issue of regulating the Internet and the question of whether it can be regulated. So Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia, was on the show last year discussing his book, Who Controls the Internet? And periodically since then, we've encountered the question of how to and whether to regulate the Internet. Frank is taking a look at this challenging question of how to and whether to regulate Google, and in particular search engines more broadly, based upon how search results are created, where those search results come from, and where it takes us. So I'm very excited to have Frank on today to talk about those issues, and also talk about, towards the end, another area of interest of his involving healthcare law. And it'll be an interesting segue, but I do want to touch on that with Frank. Very briefly, Frank joined Seton Hall Law School after practicing as an attorney at Arnold & Porter, LLP, where he worked on antitrust and intellectual property litigation. He clerked for Judge Kermit Lopez in the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, served as a fellow at the Institute for the Defense of Competition and Protection of Intellectual Property in Lima, Peru, and has various degrees as a result of being a law professor. He has a Bachelor of Arts from and Social Studies from Harvard, as well as a Master's in Philosophy and Politics from Oxford, and attended Yale Law School. So I'm very excited to have Frank on today discussing search engine regulation as well as healthcare policy. So when we return from a short music break, we will have Frank Pasquale on the show. If I've done my job properly, on the other end of the phone is Frank Pasquale. Frank, are you there?
Yes. Hey, great to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Thank you, Frank, and thanks for your immense patience in putting the show together. Frank wins the award as the most patient guest of Hearsay Culture for repeated efforts to record the show and being foiled at every turn. So, Frank, thank you so much for making the time today to talk with me on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, I wouldn't miss it.
Let's start right off with kind of a general overview. I did a brief intro of the work that you're doing, but maybe, you could certainly go into more detail. Let's talk a little bit first just about search engines, an overview of how they work and how the algorithms operate.
Sure. And in presenting this, I mean, I'm going to borrow a motive presentation from Ed Felton, who's just a great name on all these issues and a great cyber activist over at Princeton. And he was presenting at the Search Engine Law Conference in Yale in December 2005, he emphasized that there are really two important steps in any search engine process. And the first is that they go out there and they get a lot of information into a database. They gather up a lot of information via these spiders that crawl web pages and systematically copy them. And that process you've seen in the news probably in the wake of a lot of copyright disputes. I mean, as that has been going on, a lot of content providers have become somewhat unwilling content providers in sort of the search engine process. For example, as Google puts, say, not only web pages, but also books and music and sometimes movies, if they start indexing those things, or via their new subsidiary, YouTube, the content owners say, hey, wait a second, we don't want to be in there. And with web pages, it's easy to avoid that. You just put a little script called robots.txt in the coding for your web page. But for these other content providers, that's caused a bit of a controversy, and it's very interesting to see how Google has responded and how some of the search engines have responded to these entities, and this will come up a lot later on in our conversation when we talk about regulatory responses, because Google in some places says, well, this is a fair use. We have a fair use right under copyright law to make a copy, just as I could copy a few pages from a book, you know, or I could under the Sony decision, copy a television program. They say, well, we can copy this stuff into our database. We're not selling it. We're just indexing it and helping people find it.
Right.
So that's sort of on the gathering side what search engines do. However, and this is very important to later parts of our conversation, Google has also started to license content from certain providers. They're in talks with ESPN. They've got very smart people in talks with content providers. YouTube as well is in these sorts of talks. And that's an important move. So they have sort of a fight and flight response. Some people, like the publishers, they're fighting. Other people, like the AP and news providers, they're licensing from. So that's on the content gathering side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And clearly it's a competitive edge for any search engine to have as much content as possible in its database. And for a while, they had a bit of a war going on, Google, Yahoo, MSN, you know, some of the leading search engines saying, we index more. Eventually that fight stopped, and interestingly, I think it stopped in part because they like to characterize even the number of pages that they gather as a trade secret.
Interesting.
Which you saw in the whole subpoena struggle in July of last year when the U.S. government tried to subpoena Google's search results for a certain week in July or a certain month in the year as they were fighting the COPPA case. So anyway, all these are very interesting developments in terms of the content gathering side.
Go ahead.
But I mean, where my work comes in though is more on the ranking side. So once they get these huge databases, then someone has to type in a search query. Now you can search for, say, you know, coffee shops in Palo Alto or some, you know, query like that. And then when that query gets processed, then there has to be some algorithm that will go through all of these sites and then rank them and serve up those rankings in response to a particular search query.
The world of the search engine, and I'm jumping in here, but I don't want to cut you off.
Sure.
As you talk about the rankings issue, it might be helpful for the listener to talk about generally what we mean when we say ranking in connection with a search engine.
Sure. Yeah, and I've got to remember it's radio, and we've got to visualize this.
That's right. Yeah, PowerPoint's just not going to work here.
So if you could imagine, I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners, or almost all of our listeners, have used a search engine. Just imagine the page in front of you as a search page. And as you look at this page, you know, say you have your query, and say it's coffee shops in Palo Alto. At the top of the page and on the right-hand side, you're probably going to see, if you're on Google, these bluish boxes. And these are the paid results. And these are people that have paid Google some amount of money for AdWords. They're called AdWords by Google. I'm sure there's other terms for the other major search services. And they automatically get those sites, if they win the auction for these AdWords, if they bid the most, they get to be the first ones up there that are on the top of the page. And then you see those on the right-hand side. Now, below those are the organic results, the unpaid search results. And those are the ones that are generated by the algorithm. And that's when I speak about rankings, but usually, you know, your first page will have 10 of those, second page will have another 10, third page will have another 10. And so Google has to rank the results. And it's very interesting in terms of how will they rank those results. I mean, is it going to be, if it were a very primitive search engine, you know, you may be able to win by having a search engine page that says the exact quote, coffee shop in Palo Alto, 500 times. You know, if it were very primitive, you'd say, oh, wow, 500 times, that's really relevant.
Right.
You know? But the genius of Page and Brin, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, was actually in a patent for what they call page ranks. And so you can get this totally publicly accessible on the Internet because it's a patent. They patented a method whereby the rank is also determined not merely by, say, how many times the search term appears on the page, but also by the authoritativeness of the page. Hmm. And that's determined by something called backlinks. Like, if there's a certain coffee shop in Palo Alto that has, say, 50 backlinks into it, and, you know, hopefully the idea behind the algorithm would be, well, it's really popular. You know, that's 50 people have decided to link to this site. I mean, it must be a really popular coffee shop. People must really like it. On the other hand, of course, then there's ways of manipulating that, and a lot of the development of search engine algorithms has been, how do we keep making the algorithm more sophisticated in terms of determining how to serve up the ranks to the page result? Because it could be that I could also just set up 50 sites out there and link them all to my coffee shop.
Right.
You know, and that's called search engine optimization. I mean, that's a bad method of search engine optimization. There are other methods that are better, you know, but that's the way I could try to rise in the ranks, and then Google has to try to figure out, okay, or the search engine has to try to figure out, how do I avoid, or how do I not rank highly people that are merely manipulating my existing standards for deciding how something ought to be ranked.
Right. And it's an interesting area that we'll talk about a little bit later when we get into Google bombing, how people can attempt to manipulate search engine results. I want to segue into the piece you're working on, and that background I think gives us a good basis to get into this area. Given the importance of search engines, one might assume that there are regulations connected to them. But tell us, what if any regulations exist for search engines?
Sure, sure. I mean, the legal landscape is a bit complicated, and I recommend to anyone who's listening to our conversation and wants some more, there's a paper by Urs Gasser and a paper by James Grimmelman out there that really gives you the full landscape of search engine regulation. But just to dive into that, I mean, one thing that I've already mentioned that I want to just get out right away is this idea that, you know, I mentioned how there's paid results and unpaid or organic results.
Right.
A big reason for that, I mean, one reason for that is business reasons, that the search engines want to make it as clear as possible to attract customers what's paid and what's unpaid. Another reason is that the FTC, under false advertising law, has sent a letter to the major search engines saying, you really need to separate your paid and editorial content. And they try to characterize these unpaid results as a kind of editorial content. They say you need to sort of make sure that the consumer knows the difference between those things. Otherwise, that might be a violation of, say, the false advertising laws or something like that.
Right.
So that's one area, although that's not really a formal regulation. All that is something of a guidance letter, and for anyone aware of the intricacies of administrative law, I mean, this is something without really the force of law out there. In terms of other regulations, particular regulations, I mean, internationally, one really interesting thing that's occurred is in Finland, Finnish employers are prohibited from Googling their applicants.
Huh.
You apply for a job in Finland, they can't Google you without your permission because they're afraid that essentially this is like a type of information, say like a credit report, but it's a type of information that's not as well regulated as credit reports are in terms of your ability to, say, correct it, respond to it, et cetera.
So it's a check on the accuracy of the information.
Exactly, exactly. That is the Finnish concern that essentially there might be some very derogatory or damaging information that gets way up there in the results, and yet you've never really had a chance even to, you may not have even seen it.
Huh.
And if you think about, actually, the next step in search is personalized search. Okay, it's going to be search engine results that are different for every particular person and every particular company. And that, in that case, you really couldn't see. You know, it may well be that, say, the company gets results on you that are totally different from the results that you see on your computer.
You know, I want to jump in there because it's an interesting question, and I guess it begs the question of what the Internet is. Isn't there an argument to be made that, with respect to this Finnish law as you've described it, that it's defeating the purpose of the Internet in the sense that the wealth of information that's out there is designed ultimately and placed on the Internet for, among other reasons, for public consumption, and that it's a way to, by using the Internet and using a search engine in particular, you have the opportunity to cull information that you wouldn't otherwise get to make a more informed decision. The name of the show, as you know, is Hearsay Culture, and so I seize on these opportunities to kind of tie these things together because, yet again, aren't we dealing with a regulation in that case where the government or the regulatory authority is effectively being the filter to decide what is accurate, what's relevant, and what isn't? And if so, where does that leave the Internet?
Sure, sure. That is a fantastic question. And let me try to get at it in a couple of different directions. I think that one would be certainly, you know, if there are matters of public concern that are out there, we want to encourage people to have as free and open access to diverse material as possible. I mean, that's a clear First Amendment value that's out there in the case law and is pretty widely held in our society. I think, though, matters start to shift a little bit when we think about, say, particular information being offered about particular individuals and, say, even particular trademark holders. And to get back to the reputational point, I am a little worried about the idea that someone could just Google a particular applicant, say, and the applicant never really knowing or having a chance to rebut, say, what had come up in that Google search, something like that. The other aspect of this might be if you look at trademark law, Google, I've heard from its trademark counsel that they're involved in, say, thousands of trademark suits right now. You know, lots of suits, say I type in Nike, and then the first result that comes up in the unpaid results might be Reebok is a lot cheaper, or New Balance doesn't use Indonesian labor that's not fairly paid, or something like that. Okay, so in one level, it's great that they're getting an opportunity to speak about Nike, and that's a fantastic thing. But say that the third result is somebody that is, say, a pirate or is selling shoes that look just like Nike or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, then there are some concerns, and you may want to give Nike, say, a chance to, I don't know, add an asterisk after that result and say mm-hmm. that would effectively go to a point to a page that would say this is not an authorized provider of Nike shoes, or, you know, we're in lawsuits right now with them about the trade dress of our shoes or something like that. And that's one way of thinking about it. I mean, to get to your point about the, you know, this larger issue of is the government controlling what people see and why not allow there to be more of a laissez-faire provision of information, the question, I guess, even goes back to a 2001 article by Neva Elkin-Corin called Let the Crawlers Crawl. A lot of her work is just brilliant in this area. And she said, essentially, she worried, even back then, her and Helen Nissenbaum and Lucas Introna were all worrying, you know, 6 years ago, that the search engine would essentially become the bottleneck. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And say, this is sort of the bottleneck. And just as you see calls for net neutrality now, in terms of the net ops, the ISP, like the Verizon and Comcast and all the rest, that there's worry that they're going to corrode some people's access or some sites' access in order to promote those of their commercial allies or those that pay for them. You know, just as net neutrality is calling for transparency in those bottlenecks, I think to the extent that there's a dominant search engine or, say, a dominant two or three, we're going to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think just, you know, thinking analogically, let's think, you know, about if there are only, say, three big search engines, what does that call to mind? It kind of calls to my mind as having, say, three big broadcast networks that led to the development of the FCC. It also calls to mind the sort of big, having the cable duopoly, say, or the duopoly of, say, internet access that exists in many, many parts of the country, as Gigi Stone at Public Knowledge has talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's where I want to see the direction of the discourse go, although we could also talk about, you know, the characterization of Google as a speaker, as a newspaper, because that's what people really like to call it. People who want laissez-faire want to say, hey, this is just like a newspaper, you know?
Right.
That's what they want to say. It's like a newspaper, you know, for you to say they have some sort of rules that they have to put certain things in, or they have to put an asterisk in after a trademark holder, or they have to, you know, give people some sense of how they make editorial decisions. That would be like trying to force the Miami Herald to put in a right of reply statute, which, of course, was denied under Miami Herald versus Tornillo. That was seen as being against the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
So that's their characterization of it. But I like to say, well, no, I think it's a bit more like the cable network and like the must-carry rules for cable that were actually given the Supreme Court's imprimatur in the 1990s in the Turner Broadcasting decision. I think it's a lot more like that situation. But we should get into this idea of the speaker analogy, because I think that is a really powerful argument on behalf of the search engine.
Yeah, and it's definitely one that you know, gets us back to the idea of what regulation can do for search engines, not only from the perspective of the accuracy of the results, but also potentially how that impacts the user. And perhaps given the time that we have, there's probably about a half a dozen follow-up questions I would have for what you've just said. Maybe one day I'll be doing you know, a three-hour show, and then we'll be able to get into everything. But
we got to do the sequel.
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to the sequel.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, and we definitely will, because there's way too much here. I've invited a lot of people to come back based upon where we can go, and I'm intending to do. I'm starting actually to do some follow-up interviews later in the spring, and I'm looking forward to those. And there's definitely fertile ground here, especially given where what we're gonna discuss now, which is to turn really to the particular work that you're doing now. What is your general, and I think you're starting to get to it, so what is the general proposal or thesis that you're putting forth in this work?
Sure. Well, you know, I think essentially the first thing I want to say is that I followed the writing on search engine regulation in Europe and other areas, and Europe is, of course, a lot more amenable to regulation than the dominant discourse in America is, you know, represented by someone like they first say, well, the ideal thing to do in the face of, say, a dominant search engine or a duopoly or oligopoly market structure of search engines is to hope for, say, the development of a more transparent public alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of my concerns have been, I mean, so that's my first priority, is I would love to see some effort to create a more transparent public alternative. Because my worries, and a lot of the worries that I've brought up in my work, I talk about things called inclusion harms and exclusion harms. And the inclusion harm is, say, you know, there's material about you that shows up on the first page that you don't really want to be there and that you think it's kind of unfair that it's there as the first thing about you. That's an inclusion harm. An exclusion harm is, say, and this is an example from John Battelle's great book, The Search. There was a manufacturer of big feet, shoes for people with big feet. And as someone who wears size 15 shoes, this really, you know, this really struck a chord with me. This guy was under 2bigfeet.com. He was sort of the dominant, he was always coming up first in the organic search results. And then all of a sudden, right before the Christmas season, he was gone. He was like the 20th ranked or 20th page, 30th page. And if you've ever used a search engine, you know, you don't go to the 20th page. Yeah. Nobody goes to the 20th page except maybe a researcher who tries to see, you know, what's going on. And so this was what I call an exclusion harm. And Google, he wrote to Google. He was desperate. He said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I mean, I'm going to lose all my customers right before the holidays. Google just said, well, our search engine, it's all a secret. We can't tell you anything of what happened.
Hmm.
And what's odd about that is they couldn't really tell him even if, say he was just being punished, say he had bought a search engine optimizer and that had set up a link farm, what's called a link farm, they put all these links to his site, and you know, if he was being punished for being manipulating the search engine, or if this was just a natural change in the algorithm, he really didn't have a sense of that. And I think that's the problem that I want to get into is there any way, just as if your credit rating, say, drops from, you know, 800 to 500, the credit rating agency has to give you some reasons for why that happened, is there a way of working that type of, or at least creating an infrastructure for that type of transparency in the search space?
Right. And the transparency issue does lend itself to the question of what people do with that transparency. So maybe we could touch a little bit on that from the standpoint of what does transparency mean for both the search engine operator and for the user in this context?
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, well, here's, again, to get to my sort of ideal world approach first.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see, and this was an idea that was actually brought up to me back at Stanford when I presented this at the CIS, which was just a brilliant audience, a wonderful group of fellows there and students. And
that was a lot of fun.
And one of the people there mentioned, he said, you know, what you need to think about is creating a search engine which was entirely transparent. Okay, because the idea here is the current competitive model is for a search engine to say, well, we can't tell you anything about our rankings algorithm because people will manipulate the algorithm once we reveal anything about it. However, an alternate business model might be make everything completely transparent as to how it's done, and then to make it quite clear as to how people are punished if they try to manipulate that, if they try to, you know, try to game the system in order to increase the visibility or salience of their site.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's an alternative business model. It'd be great if something like that came about. There was an article in Foreign Policy recently about all these different countries who have their own search engine projects. But I'm a little worried about the possibility of that coming about for a few reasons. And one of them, I mean, you just see in the Quero project that was funded by Germany and France just broke apart.
Right.
But I also give other reasons in my work for forecasting that essentially it's going to be very hard for search engines to break into this market.
Uh-huh.
And this is a key point of disagreement between me and the more, say, market-oriented search scholars, is they believe this is a wide-open market. Anybody can crack into it. Anybody can open it up. But I have four reasons for thinking that, you know, it's going to be very hard for anybody to topple Google's dominance.
Uh-huh. And in sum, those reasons would be?
Sure. I mean, the first one would be, going back to the point we made earlier about gathering the information, if the net is sort of wide open and content is wide open, then sure, anybody could create their own index of sites. But as soon as we have these licensing deals entering the picture, like Google's licensing deal with AP and the others, those sorts of licenses are barriers to entry. If I go and try to start Frank's search engine tomorrow, you know, I've got to come up with many millions of dollars, perhaps eventually tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, to license content that's out there, that's on rival sites.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on that side. That's on the content gathering side. On the searching side, I mean, there's a lot of trade secrecy and IP rights even in the algorithm. So it may well be that Google has all the good IP in searching, and you know they've got it patented or locked up in trade secrets. Now, a lot of people doubt that. A lot of people say it's actually pretty simple and that that's not the concern here. So I don't know, but I mean the interesting thing about this is since it's also trade secreted, we don't even know. Now, returning to a theme of your work on trade secrets and public infrastructure.
Right.
A further reason that I think it's difficult to see anyone sort of breaking into this or difficult to see the market operating that well is that search is a bit of a credence good. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you go to the doctor and the doctor sort of tells you what's wrong or tells you what to do, it's very hard for you without an MD degree to second guess.
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, well, you know, actually that was a rotten doctor. I mean, you kind of got to trust what they've done for you. And the same thing with a search engine. I mean, some people say on the market side, oh, well, if the search engine doesn't provide you with good results, then if they're omitting results or knocking people out or manipulating them in some way that's not optimal for consumers, consumers are going to desert one and go to the other. But really, how does a consumer know what didn't even appear?
Right.
You know, if I'm just visiting Palo Alto for the first time and I'm looking for coffee shops and, you know, somehow the best, most wonderful one has been left off the list, you know, I'm not really going to be aware of that. I've never been there before.
Right.
And the final point I would make, the fourth reason, would be essentially the returns to scale argument that search engines, they don't merely try to get good rankings and good results via intellectual property, but as users select sites, that process itself helps them refine the results. And just to give you an example, say that I'm searching for skis, and skis in Newark, you know, Newark, New Jersey, where I am.
Uh-huh.
You know, and let's say that during that day, 100 people in Newark search for skis in Newark, and they all get the same 10 results on their page, and all of them pick the third result.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, Google has that information, and then they can use that information to say, wow, well, in the future, maybe the third result should be the first result.
Right.
And then and if you think about that process aggregated worldwide over billions of searches, I mean, that is a powerful way in which you can effectively harness the collective intelligence of groups, and this is something that, you know, maybe Jaron Lanier has talked about, or he's critiqued this, but others, lots of cyber theorists, Yochai Bankler is really a fan of this collective intelligence hypothesis, that if Google is the one, if the dominant search engine is the one that has the dominant shot at harnessing collective intelligence, you know, that's a pretty hard barrier to entry as well, because, you know, Frank's search engine that opens up tomorrow, I'm not going to have 5 billion searches on my thing, on my interface tomorrow. You know, and that also, I think, is why Google paid $1.6 billion for YouTube. It wasn't, clearly wasn't for the technology. The technology is pretty trivial. But, well, maybe there's some good aspects to it. But I mean, what they're really paying for is all the tags on all the stuff that's up there.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, all the stuff that, you know, how am I going to search for, say, comedy videos? Well, someone has, you know, tagged, collectively, millions of users have tagged things as comedy or funny or LOL or whatever.
Right.
You know, that's a huge amount of labor that essentially is going into entrenching the dominance of the leading player.
It's and of course the commercialization of all of it lends itself to the interest in that area. So it's an interesting confluence of the public knowledge concerns and the issue of collective intelligence that you've raised with in some cases converging with public interest in a positive way, and others, like in this case, I think you're making a strong case for it being a negative relationship. Well, when we return, Frank, from a short music break, I want to get into some of these interesting ideas like Google bombing and how metadata works, and then perhaps in the remaining time, turn to your other area of interest in healthcare law and stem cell research. So you're listening to KZSU, Stanford University, Hearsay Culture, with Professor Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall Law School.
Grateful Dead there with Monkey and the Engineer. And the theme of the songs on this show, for those of you listening live on KZSU, are search or engines. It's a tough one to try to find music for. Sometimes I just have to give up. But I was able, I think, to shoehorn something remotely, if humorously, perhaps relevant to the topic. Before we come back with Frank, I want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour, which is ask you for money. If you love, not for me, of course, if you love what you're listening to right now, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, public interest shows, and news by visiting kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu, and clicking on Donate to KZSU, or by writing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. You could do your part to make sure the independent sound of KZSU never dies.
So we're back with Frank, and Frank, I want to turn now, in the remaining time that we have, a little bit to some of these interesting concepts that you discuss in some detail in your work. What I mentioned the phrase Google bombing earlier, and perhaps you could define what that means, and when ultimately the question is it bad?
Excellent. Yeah, this is a fascinating concept, and this really gets to the frontiers of regulatory issues and thought about Google as this incredibly powerful intermediary. And one of the issues that came up in the political campaign in 2006, this very hotly contested campaigns in many Senate congressional seats, was many of the internet-savvy people on different campaigns were trying to ensure that the most damaging information about their opponents was the thing that came up first when people searched for them. For example, you know, with John Kyle, there was a scathing article in the New Times of Phoenix about John Kyle, just listing all of these problems with him about his representation of Arizona, inadequacies, what have you. And the people who were running against him in Arizona tried to assure that that would be the first thing that anyone searching for John Kyle would come up with on the internet. I mean, the most famous example of this heretofore is if you type in miserable failure in Google, often George W. Bush would come up as the first result. So this was a repeated effort by, you know, enemies of his to try to, you know, savvy the engineers out there in the world to figure out ways of gaming the system to make sure that he came up top. And this all sounds kind of like a parlor trick or a prank or something like that, but if you think about it a little bit more in the future, if you're thinking about it with a little bit more of a future orientation, it raises some really difficult issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can imagine, you know, people, I mean, with John Kyle, clearly he's a known quantity. People in Arizona know, you know, who he is, although of course, in today's political public sphere, I mean, when more people know who Judge Judy is than who the nine justices of the Supreme Court are, you know, that might be a heroic assumption. But let's assume for him that most people know who he is, and they could see, you know, okay, New Times, I mean, good paper, but clearly has a liberal bent. Now, though, if you think about it, if you could keep going down, you know, down to, like, the county commissioner or something like that, and think about it, like the L.A. county commissioners, many of them govern more people than, say, governors of states, you know, or something like that, but who knows who they are, and or other sorts of municipal officials. And this is pretty important because it may be the only vision of these people that, say, especially young voters are going to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be on there. Now, the question arises, all right, what is Google going to do about, say, political Google bombing if they feel like their search is being manipulated? And that's where, I mean, clearly I don't have a regulatory solution right now. I can't say, oh, they should do X, Y, and Z. However, whatever they do ought to at least arouse the attention and the interest of people who are interested in our political public sphere, because let's say they say in response to that, well, any densely interlinked partisan sites, that's going to be suspect if they start linking to certain news articles or something like that. Okay. Now, on one level, that would get rid of, say, the Google bombing of John Kyle in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you would knock off that New Times article, or you'd stop the manipulation there. But the rule, if applied generally, sounds a little odd, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like,
yeah.
I mean, if you're punishing people for essentially creating these types of cyber spaces to talk about candidates and to interlink one another, et cetera. And I'm not saying that's, but and the ultimate irony, though, is we have no idea what they're doing in response to this stuff. We have absolutely no idea.
Right.
We have no idea, for example, why net neutrality. You know, if you look up net neutrality on Google, at least when I did about a month ago, I mean, the top 10 results were all in favor of net neutrality, which is, you know, a business thing that really helps Google. However, I mean, I'm not saying, though, that Google has done that, you know, just in order to skew public perception of net neutrality. I'm just saying that, well, we don't really know how that came about.
Right.
We really have no idea how that came about.
Well, and it does lead to the issue that certainly you mentioned I'm very interested in, and something that you've mentioned here, which is trade secrecy, but more broadly secrecy in general. And right. I guess, you know, the question arises whether the revelation of the algorithm itself, which presumably Google would argue is a trade secret and may be patented, but that doesn't necessarily impact its ability to be made public. So let's assume for the moment that there's a trade secrecy argument to be made on behalf of Google regarding their algorithm. What would, or what do you think would be the result, assuming for the moment that this could happen, of publicizing or making public the algorithm of Google? Now, I'm putting aside, you know, the commercial impact questions and just looking at it from the standpoint of its impact on the user and, again, on getting accurate or clear or non-skewed results. What's your thoughts on that?
Sure. And, I mean, this gets into some other really interesting issues in terms of open source in general, and sort of open source software, open source methods of providing content. I mean, one way that the horror story or the nightmare scenario that would happen would be that suddenly all the search engine optimizers that heretofore have had to laboriously guess at what the Google algorithm is would suddenly just attack, and it would be pure spam. Google would be entirely full of spam. Almost any search result would get corrupted, manipulated, and that they would be able to, you know, just run roughshod over it. And in fact, some people predict that intermediaries that make public their algorithms for permitting, putting content out there, that will happen or is happening. Some people say that will happen to Wikipedia. I think Eric Goldman predicts that within 5 years, Wikipedia will be overrun by spammers. Mm-hmm. Precisely because people know how to manipulate the system, or because it's so public about how editorial decisions are made, that people will try to overrun that system. So that's a real problem, and that's a real worry. And I do worry about that possibility. I mean, the happier scenario would be that somehow they managed to also simultaneously make public methods of punishing people and show how they punish people. And this is something that's part of Jennifer Chandler's work at University of Ottawa. She's talked a lot about if a search engine decides to just knock a page off or just not to even index it at all, that there should be some publicly accessible list of those sites. So if you develop some of those ideas out, you could say, well, there may be some initial switching costs to that sort of system, but perhaps eventually they would be able to make it public enough, the method of punishment for manipulating the algorithm, that things would ultimately work out all right in the end.
What may be a basic question, but wouldn't a spam filter and good technology there save entities like Wikipedia and Google from that problem? Of course, it gets back to the issue. Now we're getting back to filtering information and changing it as opposed to just making it public for anyone to use. But how much of a solution is that basic idea of just filtering out the spam?
Right. I mean, that may well be a good solution. I mean, I'm always amazed at this sort of Turing test arms race that's going on in so many different areas. Like even in Second Life and some of these game scenarios or game scenarios that are kind of like Second Life, where people send out these robots to mine gold, and then they have to be questioned by actual players of the game to figure out if they're really players who are mining the gold or if they're actually just bits of code that are cloaked as avatars or what have you.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's it's going to be a huge problem, you know. And given the vitality of this SEO business, I mean, it's amazing when you look at, say, SearchEngineWatch.com or some of these, or Battelle SearchBlog or some of these other people that follow the industry, given how many resources are in this already, this sort of parasitic industry that's sort of parasitic off of Google and its dominance, that is a worry. It's a real worry. And so I don't know. I mean, I really would have to know a lot more about spam filtering to
right.
to estimate that.
But you wouldn't, I mean, I guess I'm not trying to put you on the spot with the specifics of spam filters, but you wouldn't rule it out as at least something that could be considered under your rubric of how search engines are operating.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think it's that would work in very synergistically with my work, yeah.
Okay. In the remaining few minutes we have, and it's kind of a hard segue, so I'm just going to turn to it. I know that you've also taken a look in the past and looking at now some issues involving stem cell research. And perhaps I will ask you the broadest of all questions, one that I could probably just turn off my mic and go read a book for a half hour. But maybe, but I won't do that. In fact, we don't have that kind of time. So I will just ask you, where are we as far as stem cell research and the science that you see today?
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, if I could just step back a bit just to help ease the segue. I mean,
right.
I just wanted to give people a sense of, you know, how do I come to be interested in all these things? And I think the one...
Other than being a Renaissance person.
Yeah, I try to be. But I mean, the main thing that I find in terms of... I do both intellectual property and healthcare, and we have a couple of institutes in both of these areas at Seton Hall where I teach. And to me, these are two areas of law where if you're thinking about policy, you're thinking about the big picture, it can be very, studying one can really help you understand the other and vice versa. And I want to give a few reasons for that. One being that essentially these are pervasively regulated industries where without a background of extensive government intervention and delineation of property rights, there is no market. Okay, you can't imagine a market in IP without sort of IP rights and all sorts of regulations and court decisions talking about those and determining those, and it's still incredibly live and in flux to this day. I mean, there's so much copyright legislation in the 90s, and patent reform being considered now. All of that's extremely important. And if you think about healthcare law, I mean, very similar. I mean, about 50% of healthcare spending in the U.S. is done by the U.S. government. So I mean, we're halfway to nationalized healthcare. And that's a really interesting thing to be thinking about in terms of how do these two areas or industries that are pervasively regulated, how do we develop policy in each of those where the market is really sort of in the background,
right,
vis-a-vis law.
And also where the funding itself issues come up, where the government funding in these areas, and certainly in many of these areas, is decreasing, especially from the internet perspective, as the government's less and less involved in its creation. So,
absolutely. I mean, all of IP policy in each of these areas, there's very difficult policy decisions to be made about the allocation of the social production of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What is allocated to the market? What is allocated to academia? What's allocated to nonprofits in general? So that's key. And so each of these areas, I think, they benefit from looking at each other. The other issue that I really am concerned about, and this will work us into the regenerative medicine question, is I'm very interested in what is the minimum that everybody gets. Okay, what is the minimum of access to technology that people get, both in terms of patented, copyrighted materials and in terms of healthcare in general?
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's brought up, say, in terms of universal access requirements and who gets broadband and who doesn't. It's brought up in other areas. And how I can work this in terms of an interest in healthcare is one of the big problems that I see in healthcare right now that I think is really undercovered in the literature is I think there is a very interesting relationship between the frontiers of healthcare and, say, minimum access to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the story that people try to tell about healthcare and the development of healthcare in the United States now is, well, there's all this innovation at the top and eventually it trickles down to the bottom. And that story is certainly accurate, certainly valid in many areas of pharmaceuticals and in other areas. But you are also seeing simultaneously in today's society a lot of innovation that, say, is being very helpful to the top, a lot of things like, say, specialty hospitals or certain types of research, say, in the regenerative therapies areas like stem cell research, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That is all money that's doing a lot of good, but it is on some level, due to our system of cross-subsidies, it's also leading to a diversion of resources, say, to those at the bottom. And there's a lot of interesting policy decisions that have to be made in all sorts of areas, say, in broadband and internet access. Are we going to try to create a system that, say, gets as rapid service as possible to those who are willing to pay the most? Or are we willing to sort of slow down the whole thing just to make sure we have universal access?
Right. Well, you've done a great job of segueing this. You know, this is actually the connection is very interesting too, because one, and going back a few years for me, but I did some work on policy level involving the allocation of resources vis-a-vis just reducing the federal debt and the deficit, and looking at ultimately, because entitlements are such a big, the entitlement, quote-unquote, that exists, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, things like that, looking at where those resources are going, and there's a very interesting analysis that continues on the allocation of resources for individuals in the last years of their life versus for children, and,
sure.
and how those decisions are made. And the connection that I think you're drawing here is similarly those competing kinds of interests.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you think about, see, for example, one of the things that I've written about is boutique medicine and sort of concierge healthcare. And this is what happens in a constant, and that's a great analogy you're drawing in terms of this allocation across different age levels. In a boutique medicine practice, what happens is, say, you've got three doctors and they have a panel of, say, 2,500 patients that they see that they have in their practice. These doctors will go to the 2,500 patients and say, listen, we want more leisure and we want to give you more intense health care. So the 400 of you who pay us an extra $5,000 a year, we're going to see you people and we're going to give you next day access to, or same day access to appointments, email access, special waiting rooms, preventive health care, all this counseling. We're going to give you marquee, premium, gold-plated primary care. But then the other 2,100 are gone.
Right.
They don't get anything from that practice. I mean, they have to find another practice.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's innovation. That's getting more money into the system. It's great. Well, it would be great if you could get more doctors coming in to compete. But you've got the number of doctors is fixed.
Right.
It'd be a licensing requirements. And very similar with IP. IP sort of, you know, if you have maybe a lot of money coming in on the high end, maybe it's going to create more IP, but maybe they'll just encourage providers of IP to switch to a high-margin, low-volume business model where they're essentially couriers.
Are there, I'm curious, as you describe these links, are there a group of scholars that are looking at these what are almost interdisciplinary analyses of the allocation of resources this way?
Well, you know, I think within healthcare, there is some very good work done on this sort of diversionary impact, particularly internationally, because the U.S., a lot of the U.S. market-based system has, and private health insurance is becoming more prevalent in countries that have, say, universal healthcare. And so the question they're facing is, will the development of private healthcare divert resources from the public healthcare system?
Mm-hmm.
And that was an epical decision in Canada last year called Chouly versus Quebec, which, you know, dealt with these issues and was a very, basically said that people had a substantive right to private health insurance, even diversionary effect be damned.
Right.
And within copyright, there's some great work being done by Anupam Chander and Molly Van Howling and there's some other people who work on the distributive values of copyright, who think about the distributive impact of copyright, Ann Bartow. You know, they're all doing really interesting work on there. You know, and I'm essentially what I'm trying to do eventually is to write a book called Separate Lives, The Legal Intensification of Inequality in America, looking at sort of how artificial scarcity in each of these realms is structurally parallel and how it might be alleviated, how we might find a more win-win situation.
And what's I won't put you on the spot, but what's your ultimate goal with that work in terms of when we can find it? I'm not going to ask you to, like, you know, it'll be out next September.
This is a long term project. There's all these fascinating things like search engines to tour me, but
right.
You know, actually though, the search engine though thing is actually of a piece as well, because I think one of my biggest worries about search engines is actually about bidding for AdWords.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm very worried that essentially if there's going to be this commodification of salience via the bidding for AdWords, and to the same extent that there's a commodification of competence in primary care. You know, it used to be the kind of who got the best doctor. It was a little random, you know, but if you have these sort of new methods of healthcare financing where people can essentially are tiered, not merely these rough tiers we have in our healthcare system, but really lots of tiers, where essentially you have, say, the best doctors invariably going to the people who have the most money or willing to pay the most for them,
mm-hmm.
you know. Very interesting, too, in terms of the commodification of salience in our society. If everyone's looking at Google for their ads, if that's the way basically a lot of advertising is done, you have a much more direct commodification of salience, say, of who gets attention and who does not. And that's, I think, why its market cap is so high. It's
uh-huh.
because, you know, investors are sort of thinking, wow, there's a lot of money to be made there in terms of if you could really systematically price discriminate and squeeze as much money as possible out of people in auctions for salience.
Right, and the commodification point, and we only have about 30 seconds left. is an interesting point to close on, because throughout this conversation, what we're talking about here is ultimately, at some level, a conflict between those that are looking to put content on the internet and use the internet for interests other than the commercial interest, and Wikipedia being the example, versus the challenge of having to have companies and entities that need to feed their children and make sure that the roof stays on their head, and how they interact with the technology the same way. And this constant conflict between non-commercial and commercial interests seems to animate all of what we're discussing, both from the healthcare perspective as well as the search engine perspective.
Absolutely.
Well, Frank, on that note, and you've I think left so many cliffhangers that I would be doing not only me but the listeners a disservice to not say that I will look forward to speaking to you again in the near future, and in the long term future, I look forward to your book, which sounds fascinating. You've also mentioned in closing a number of resources that people can look to learn more about these issues. I do want to close with asking you if there's any other resources or places where people can learn more about these issues.
Sure. Well, what I will try to do is I have a blog called Madisonian.net and ConcurringOpinions.com.
Mm-hmm.
These are two places where I blog, and I will try to follow up this interview with the things that I've mentioned today, and I'll try to put an additional list there. I would just encourage people to look internationally. That's a huge thing. It's become a bit of a obsession of mine, is how do we improve American law? And I think one of the key things is to see what are other countries doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would Europe do? You know, in particular situations, what is being done in South Korea? I mean, how did South Korea get to the point where essentially they have a really rationalized system of music distribution now, which we should get into another discussion, where people can get access to everything for $5 a month.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Let's look at how these other countries are getting ahead of us. You know, why are there 20 countries ahead of us in broadband penetration?
Mm-hmm.
Let's look internationally, and I'm going to try to make that a theme of my blogs this year. That's my New Year's resolution, and I will try to put up a post that is, you know, includes keywords like Levine, Pasquale, international resources, et cetera, that will be easily Googleable for the listeners, so they can find all the stuff we've mentioned today.
And actually, after the music break, I'm actually going to mention something about that, because I should be able to add that resource to the website that I've created for the page. It will be live very soon. Well, Frank, I want to thank you for joining me today and for discussing these fascinating issues and for really doing the great work that you're doing.
Hey, thank you. This is a terrific show and a great service to the community.
Well, thank you, Frank. I enjoy doing it, and having guests like you is the reason why it is so much fun. And I thank you for being here today.
Hey, thank you, Dave.
I want to thank Frank Pasquale for being on today and discussing all of these issues. And I also want to thank him for mentioning the blog work that he's doing, because both of the blogs that Frank mentioned I would highly recommend to anyone interested, not just in these issues, but in technology generally. There's an amazing collection of people both on both blogs that Frank mentioned, Madisonian and Concurring, and they're both really outstanding resources. In connection with what Frank was saying at the end of the interview, I've been mentioning for a number of months at this point that I have a web page that I'm putting together, and I can say now at this point that it is virtually done. And by virtually done, I mean literally that it will be live within the next week. I'm really putting the finishing touches on it. But one of the things that I intend to do with the blog is to allow for listeners who are listening to the show either live on KZSU or by iTunes podcast, or by downloading it off the webpage itself, to find the links that the guests mention and other resources that we discuss. And so Frank is really doing a great service in going ahead and putting those blog entries on, and I will link to those as well, so you will have the ability, after you listen to the show, to follow up on the resources and the research that the guest mentions. So I'm very much looking forward to doing that, and I'm looking forward to having the website live. The website address is www.hearsayculture.com, and that's HEARSAY culture.com. Right now, it is password protected, but that's only because I'm putting the finishing touches on it. It will certainly be live within the next week. This show is being recorded on January 23rd, and will be aired on January 24th. So you can definitely look for the website to be live by the end of the year. And you'll also be able to find all kinds of other information, the schedule of guests, the previous shows, a blog roll, and things like that. So I want to thank Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School for being on today. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Stanford. Please stay tuned for Mike and A Baptism of Solitude, and I will look forward to talking to you next week.